Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Thursday, the 20th of April this year, marks the 80th birthday of Sir John Eliot Gardiner. Sir John was in Hamburg recently, just about a week ago, and performed in the Grand Hall together with the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists, the B minor Mass of Johann Sebastian Bach's. It was an amazing evening and he left a stunned audience. I spoke with him just, you know, around noon that very same day, and I must apologize for the voice that you will just hear, because my voice is really pretty, muffled, and I had this, you know, residues of a bad cough and wasn't really in my power, so to speak. But that doesn't matter that much, because John Eliot Gardiner was tremendously in his power and his voice sounds as if he was half his age, maybe, yeah, like a 40-year-old man, if at all. A singer's voice, a wonderful voice, telling so much about Bach, about his lifelong connection with Bach. And we also spoke about his very long connection with the King Charles, His Majesty King Charles III, the new King of England, whose coronation concert he will be a big contribution to. And we tried to talk also a bit about agricultural subjects, but I have to admit that my knowledge about this area is not too deep. And his, of course, is also very deep, because he has been a farmer all his life, a farmer and a wonderful musician and a brilliant human being. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you. Sir John, I say Sir John, yeah, is that sure? Appropriate? I'm really delighted to have you here, and it is really a big honor.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
And I'm very aware that we are just a week short of a certain date in your biography.
Yes.
And I was wondering, tonight you are going to conduct B minor Mass of Bach's, and apparently, supposedly, reportedly, this is your favorite piece of music. Did you choose this deliberately because you knew, I'm going to be 80 then, and maybe then I should surround myself with the dates around this?
No, that's much too neat. And it didn't work that way. It just so happens that my relationship to Bach's B minor Mass happens, it has always happened in my life, in 10-year segments.
Okay.
I first encountered or first heard the Hamol Messe when I was 10 years old, when my parents bought Herbert von Karajan's first recording of the Mass, and they played it endlessly. And I was at a stage when I was learning the motets of Bach, the treble parts, the soprano parts, which I learnt by heart, auswendig, by the time I was 11 or 12. And I loved that. Then I heard this recording of the B minor Mass, which was presented to me by my parents as the magnum opus, the ne plus ultra. And I found it intimidating and quite repellent in the way that it was performed under Karajan's directorship.
How amazing that you had this artistic discernment at that age.
Well, I don't think I was particularly musically precocious. It was just that I'd learnt these motets and I'd learnt to sing, and I loved that. And then I heard this hideous sound coming from the massed chorus that he used. And I think it was the Berliner Philharmonic, I imagine it was. And it, later on, looking back on it, I realized it was indistinguishable in style from Mahler's Eighth Symphony. But as an interpretation of Bach, it made me very uncomfortable. And then 10 years later, I heard the B minor Mass for the first time live at the Royal Festival Hall, conducted by Sir David Wilcox and the Bach Choir of London, massive choir. And it had a very strong sense of ritual and of Victorian sanctimoniousness,
solemn and heavy
solemnity and
velvety.
Yes, and something that didn't seem to me to fit. And then when I was 30, 10 years after that, I conducted it for the first time. with the Monteverdi Choir and with modern instruments, the Monteverdi Orchestra, at the Proms, the BBC Proms.
72, 73 then.
73.
Must have been, yeah, exactly.
With wonderful soloists, Eli Ameling, Janet Baker, Alexander Young, Thomas Allen, all sitting in the front of the choir and the orchestra, you know, in their party frocks. And that was a big experience for me, conducting that for the first time, age 30. Then the next stage was when Karl Richter died, and Deutsche Grammophon approached me and said, step into his shoes, and would you record the Hammelmesse for us for Archivproduktion?
Oh, yeah.
And that was in 85, and that was a huge challenge and Unternehmung, you know, an undertaking.
In which way? Because the conception was so different between...
Well, yes, and because it seemed to me that there were two extreme choices, that and neither of which I felt comfortable with. One was the old choral society approach, and many voices, big orchestra, and so on. And I'd heard Richter do it in Munich, and even though I respected him and admired him, and he was very... He had a very, very deep knowledge and a deep instinct for Bach. It wasn't, I didn't feel complete, I could identify with it. The other was the new, much trumpeted fashion that had just come into existence in the 1980s, which was for minimal forces, one to a part.
Mm-hmm. It was chamber choir, kind of.
Well, not even a chamber choir. I mean, yes. It was just a consort of five singing, and it seems to me completely illogical. I mean, Bach writes his Kyrie and Gloria for five voices, and then he adds a sixth voice for the Sanctus, and then eight voices for the Hosanna. So how many voices are you meant to use? And yeah. It turned out to be what was called rather sort of cheekily the B minor madrigal. And I couldn't find a historical or a aesthetic or a philosophical justification for going down that route. I mean, technically, are you meant to balance three trumpets and drums against five solo singers?
Virtually impossible.
You can do it in a recording studio, but you can't do it in and so those were the two options, and I decided no, I would like to stick with a virtuoso chamber choir, which the Monteverdi choir had become by then, and period instruments, which I was completely in love with, not as a kind of fetish or as an overall solution to all problems, but just simply I love the colours and I love the experimental nature of Bach's use of mm-hmm. period instruments. And also the thing that I've always been aspiring to, which is deep complicity between instruments and voices, so that the instruments are not there simply to accompany, but that they actually reflect the text of the singers, and the singers emulate the virtuosity of the instrumental.
Of the instrumentalists.
So yeah. There's complete complicity, and it's something that is a kind of mantra for me to achieve that in all sorts of styles, whether it's a Beethoven Missa Solemnis or the Bach Hammelmesse or Monteverdi Madrigal, to find that complete identity between voices and instruments, mm-hmm. Which seems to me so important in Bach, and which, of course, in the Thomasschule, he emulated anyway, because he educated his Thomana to be able to sing or to play in instruments. And sometimes when they were sick, you know, he had to substitute an oboe for a tenor, or he played the keyboard himself. So that is really important. So that was my first recording of it. And then 30 years later, I re-recorded it for SDG, our own label. Mm-hmm. And that changed things, because I'd, in the interim, had the experience of going through all the church cantatas in the year 2000 in our great...
A new big approach,
yes,
to having them all.
And, you know, that was such an overwhelming experience of getting to know these extraordinarily profound pieces that are unduly neglected, apart from a handful, even to this day, and are performing them in their right time slot in the church year and mm-hmm. in the geophysical year.
Yeah.
And also there were a lot of musicians who had played a role in that Bach Cantata pilgrimage who were then there to help and to perform the B minor mass when we re-recorded it in 2015. So they had been in the trenches with me, as it were.
Perfectly prepared for this endeavor.
And the experience of the cantatas changes one's attitude towards the mass, because so many of the movements of the 27 movements of the mass are recycled cantata movements.
Yeah.
And that is, in a way, an astounding fact. that Bach had this ability to look at a piece of music and to find different outcomes for it, different places.
Purposes that where he would use it.
Yes. Yeah. And then to construct such a satisfying, overall, overarching work made up at different stages of his career and composed of so many different elements, separate elements. It's just an astonishing feat for any musician, but you never feel, well, I never feel with when I'm conducting the Be My Master that it's just an assembly of different pieces. I feel, even though I tell myself and I know that Bach, when he composed the Kyrie and the Gloria, the short mass in 1733 for Dresden, that he wasn't thinking at that stage in
the big arc.
In the big arc. But nonetheless, at the back of his mind, at who knows at what stage, he thought, yes, maybe I can use this as the basis of a Missa Tota, of a big Catholic mass, and a great summation of his artistic credo himself. And that's what's so moving. And as a conductor, your responsibility in the very first upbeat that you give for the Kyrie at the beginning is to have the whole of the unfolding of the Mass in your head, latent in your imagination, knowing how to structure it, how to pace it, how to calibrate it.
But that, to some extent, applies to all conducting, right?
Oh, it does.
You always have to know about the ending before you start the first beat. But then I wonder, there must be two things. Having conducted all these cantatas must have made things also a bit easier or lighter. And at the same time, having this architectural view of how it's all pieced together. So it must be a very sure way of approaching this.
It is comforting,
project.
Yes, yeah. And knowing that the Crucifixus comes from Weinenklagen, from Weimar of 1714. But then how are you to manage the Et Incarnatus, which precedes the Crucifixus, which was probably the last piece he wrote in 1749, in the year of his death, or just before he died.
Yeah.
And yet when you do the Et Incarnatus, which is written, as you know, in 3-4, and it goes into the Crucifixus, which is written in 3-2. Is there a big clash of gears? Is there great? No, there isn't. It's extraordinary. I mean, that's something that's so rare and so admirable about Bach that doesn't matter if it was a very early piece or a very late piece. You can't say that's an early style.
Bach,
that's it is him. It is his extraordinary, almost superhuman capacity to find in musical notation a way of expressing his devotion, his theological awareness, but also his critique of Lutheran theology. And to me, the entscheidende Punkt, the decisive moment to me in the whole of the Be My Mass is in the Credo at the Confiteor, because there he goes, Confiteor in unum baptisma in remissionem peccatorum. And he does it in such a very, very assured and confident and rhetorical way of blasting out the words in cantus firmus, but first of all with the basses and altos and then the tenors. And then the most extraordinary thing happens. The whole edifice, the whole building crumbles. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, what is going on here? What happened? And he goes into the most peculiar harmonic contortions and distortions. And if you look at the autograph, you can see the revisions that he put in. And he goes through diminished sevenths, and he goes through enharmonic changes and all sorts of searching, probing investigations of what the meaning is of in remissionem peccatorum. And before, eventually, it comes out into the sunlight, into the Et Expecto, and we have the trumpets back again, and you're in D major, and life is good again. What's going on there? I mean, and it's troubled me for years, and this is a very subjective and personal response to it, but I feel it's Bach's own belief system having a momentary question
mark. Of questioning, yeah.
That he is, you know, he's been through so much in his life. He's always had a problem with authority. He lost his parents when he was 8-9 years old, both of them. He had a rough time early on in his life by being orphaned. He had a conflict already when he was in his first job in Arnstadt with a bassoonist. His music He had problems in Mühlhausen. He had problems in Weimar with the two warring dukes who put him in prison because he wanted to leave to Köthen. The only happy period of his life really was in Köthen. Then he took, with certain misgivings, the job in Leipzig. And from the moment he arrived in Leipzig, he was under a most appalling pressure because the Stadtrat, I mean, they deceived him because they provided him a contract which didn't conform with the Neue Ordnung and the new regulations applying to the Thomaskirche, to the Thomasschule. In other words, limiting his authority to choose the best, select the best musicians because they had to pass an academic exam. That was disreputable because it was not legal and it was not fair on Bach at all. And then he had problems with the clergy. I don't think the clerics in Leipzig, those who were more pietistic and those who were more orthodox, I don't think they ever understood his aim to compose a well-regulated church music to the glory of God. I don't think they ever got that. And I think they were jealous of him, that the success that he had with his cantatas as opposed to their sermons, they didn't really support him, or very few. So, you know, by the time of the 1730s, when he'd done his initial three or maybe more, four, who knows, cycles of cantatas, he was to some extent disillusioned. And that's when he started to compose less for the church, and he went over to Zimmermann's coffee house and started to doing his own Collegium Musicum and doing Brandenburg concertos and clavier concertos and so on, so on. And then came the opportunity, he saw a new opportunity for an opening in Dresden at the Sophienkirche, not for himself, but for his eldest son, Wilhelm Friedemann. And that's when the Mass began, the Miss and the Kyrie and the Gloria. And even though Bach got the title that he wanted from the elector, he stayed in Leipzig and he went back to composing church music. But he was always unter Druck. He was always under pressure, it seemed to me. And he had a good deal of self-reflection. And he had a terrible temptation, it seems to me, that of interfering in other people's fights, battles. He didn't just stick to his own. He would intervene unnecessarily.
Mingle into other people.
Yes, unnecessarily. So he had philosophical doubts, philosophical moments of doubt. And that's what we find in the section of the Confiteor, which is so touching. It makes him so much more human.
Human, yeah. It's utterly fascinating listening to you. I mean, I know you have written hundreds of pages about Bach's life and you're really deeply, deeply into this. I wonder how much of this really goes through your head when you are on the stand conducting. Is it like you don't think of it, or do you do?
Not really, because I'm, you know, as a conductor, you're thinking in terms of three time frames. You're thinking of the bar, the measure that you're in. You're thinking of the phrase that you're in, or the movement you're in, and you have an overarching concept of how the piece is unfolding. So you're constantly shifting between three different time frames to control. And also you're busy being... you don't have this word in German. I mean, a dirigent is very different from a conductor. A conductor is like a lightning conductor. What is the word for
Ableiter. Blitzableiter.
Blitzableiter.
Yeah. Or a conduit.
A conduit. Yeah. And that's... which I love the image of that.
That's interesting.
I'm there to take the energy.
Channeling the energy.
Channel it.
Bringing it down and transporting it.
And to convey it to the musicians and to the audience. So that's my priority.
Yeah, that's a very different approach of...
Dirigieren is much more
it's
kind
more
of...
authoritarian.
Authoritarian.
Kind of, yeah. I am the one and I'm holding the baton. And
but that's ridiculous, really. It's particularly when you're doing music nowadays and also music, Baroque music, because it's not dirigier music, it's more enabling music and
breathing
and allowing or encouraging an atmosphere wherein everybody in the group, whether they're a singer, whether they're a solo singer, an obbligato player or a continuo player or a tutist, can contribute in a way that they feel it makes a difference.
Yeah. You put it once so nicely that one of the tasks of a good conductor would be to make the musicians believe that the decisions that you take as a conductor actually have been theirs. And I think there is, of course, it's a funny way of looking at it, but there's certainly also some truth in it, because, I mean, these musicians today, they are really very, very informed, and they bring a lot to the table once you meet and you absolutely. Play as you've been playing with them for, I don't know, for ages.
For ages, and that's absolutely true. And it's a much more convivial and atmosphere, if you can bring that. I mean, it doesn't mean that you have to ignore or duck out of the responsibilities, because ultimately it stops with you. That if you can carry people along with you and they feel that they can express themselves, it's a much, much more pleasant way of and a more constructive way of going about things. And I, not just as with my own group, but also when I'm guest conducting. I mean, I've been recently with the Bayerischer Rundfunk Symphony mm-hmm. Orchestra, and we were doing a program, beautiful program, of Haydn, Schubert, and Weber. And they are such a flexible orchestra and so engaged that if you encourage them in a certain way, they will take that responsibility and, mm-hmm. and repay it in the most beautiful way.
And something similar might be happening with the Concertgebouw when you come back in May with the four Brahmses. Yes. Which is, of course, in Hamburg. I mean, being in his hometown.
That'll be so moving to me.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was with the Norddeutsche Symphony Orchestra, I tended to avoid doing Brahms because my predecessor, Günter Wand, had done so much Brahms and Bruckner and so on. To come here with the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, who is a wonderful orchestra, and to present the Zyklus here in Brahms's hometown will be a great, great honour.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, you have told me about this first conducting of the B minor Mass in London in 83.
73.
It was 30, yeah, 73. How I mean, this is 50 years
50
ago.
Years ago.
Incredible. How does that feel? I mean, you've answered it partly by saying, I mean, how much more confidence there is. And of course, with the players and all this interaction is so much more. But and also the knowledge about the music. And I think also the knowing that the acceptance of how you interpret and how you want to bring this music to our ears as contemporaries has so much evolved in the last half century, right?
I hope so, yes. I really do hope so.
Doesn't that give a feeling of I have achieved something here?
Not really, because as a musician, your job is to develop and to deliver in that moment today, not the way you did it yesterday, nor the way you do it tomorrow, but to do it now, to connect with the zeitgeist. It's really important as a recreative art form. It's not like a painting that you can look at from different angles and walk, or a sculpture that you can walk around. You are actually, in a way, influencing much more than a spectator is of an art piece. You're influencing the unfolding and presentation.
And the perception.
And the perception of that artwork. And that is, it can be overwhelming, and you can feel overburdened. You feel like Atlas holding up the whole world on your shoulders.
Sisyphus, kind of.
Yes, yes. Or you can feel energized by that opportunity. And it seems to me, in a world such as we're living at the moment, which is so gefährlich, it's so dangerous, in that there are so many potential flashpoints mm-hmm. going on in the world at the moment, where it makes you feel, I don't know what it does you, but it makes me feel very kind of incapacitated, impotent in a way to influence events. You've got to then say, well, look, what do I have? And what I do have is access to this magnificent music, which can give inspiration, give comfort, give Trost, the great, mm-hmm. wonderful word that
in German, yeah.
that in German. And Bach gives Trost in a way that no other composer I know of can give Trost to people who are anxious, who are suffering, who are grieving, who are finding life so incredibly difficult at the moment. And that's what you have to focus on, and to make sure that everybody in the choir and the orchestra is alive to the potential.
And responsive to what's
And responsible.
There.
I mean, it's like Homer when he describes Achilles' shield, you know, and he says that there are live creatures and parts actually on the shield, and mm-hmm. it comes alive. That's how you need to feel when you're performing Bach in today, in 23.
Meaning like there is no such thing as this is how
Definitive.
I've been doing it for the last 50 years and this is how it's been done.
No.
Which is so wonderful, and which really ensures for some kind of eternal youth, because you are always in the present, or you have to be always in the, if it's good and you want it to be good, of course, you have to be in the present moment all the time. And I mean, if I look at you, I mean, turning 80, so it's just like an illusion almost.
Oh, you're very kind.
No, really, I mean it. It's quite something.
You know, we none of us know how long we have, do we? And Luther puts it so strongly in some of the texts that Bach sets, you know, wer weiß wie nahe meine Ende, you know, and who is...
Luckily, we don't know.
Luckily, we don't know, and we don't know how the God keeps the clock on us. We don't know. But we do know that we have to use the time. We have to use the time.
Change of subject. King Charles, you are going to play and have your choir come to his coronation ceremony, which I find is fabulous, of course. I'm not too much of a royalist as a German, of course, and as a Hamburger, of course.
You just welcomed him last week, didn't you?
You know what? He didn't come to Elbphilharmonie, and I was really, personally, a bit disappointed. And I think it's just because of his role. He can't do all this art-loving stuff anymore to the extent that he could do when he was still the prince. And I know that you have a good relationship, the two of you, and how much he loves music. But he was, I mean, he did the Biobauernhof in Brandenburg, but in Hamburg, instead of coming here. And his son, William, was here with Kate. Kate was actually conducting a Hamburger Symphonica for 2 or 3 bars. They were just rehearsing in the Grand Hall, and they came and paid a visit. And
it was
really funny. And he was offered the baton, and he said, no, I can't do it. And Kate, of course, she said, I can do it.
She's unternehmungslustig.
She's a very vivid person. I love it. So he couldn't, the protocol wouldn't allow. Okay, so he didn't come, but you will be playing and performing at the coronation ceremony. And is there a fixed repertoire that you have to follow? Krönungsmessen and stuff? Or is it, have you dealt with him? What are you going to play?
Put it this way, I've had discussions with him. I've made proposals to him. Because I love coronations, and we have a long history of coronations. And, you know, take Georg Friedrich Händel, who, you know, for George II of Hanover, he wrote this marvelous Zadok the Priest for George II's coronation. And
Benjamin Britten, wasn't that also for coronation?
But it's a secular opera.
Yeah, okay, but that's close to...
Oh, yes. And the king has commissioned a number of works.
So you love coronations, and
well, I do, and you know, he is so approachable, and he's our Schirmherr, he's our patron, as Prince of Wales, and I was so thrilled when he told me that he was going to continue as king, as our patron, and so he engaged me in discussions and conversations about what would be appropriate, and I put forward certain ideas, and it came back to me, yes, this would be acceptable, and he would like to do that. And not only that, but would I please start the whole proceedings with the first 20 minutes of the service or the pre-service, and that he, of course, will be in his carriage coming from Buckingham Palace to the Abbey, so he won't be able to hear it. So would it be all right if he came to the rehearsal? And of course, of course I said yes. But it's wonderful to have a monarch who is so committed to the performing arts, because wonderful though his mother and our queen was, that wasn't her priority, not her main thing. She was wonderful in so many other ways, but
that was not her forte.
No, and Charles is so ahead of his time in many, many ways in the causes that he favors, that he encourages, and I mean, he has a genius for convening people together, bringing people together who otherwise wouldn't meet to discuss, whereas politicians are constricted.
Unilateral.
Yes, constricted by their policies and by their electorate and so on. He has always, well, ever since I've known him, had this incredible ability to bring people together and to discuss really important issues of the time, whether it be the education of inner cities children or giving them skills in artisan work or the big issues of climate change or of the Amazon forests or of sustainable farming, all these things where he's way ahead. And he's been
ahead
of his time and often mocked and derided by the press. And it's been very painful for him. And yet he's been proved right all along in so many, many ways. And I admire him and I bond with him at a personal level, even though I'm I'm his servant. I'm not a friend.
I'd like to say a friend,
but I'm not a chum with him. You know,
yeah.
I revere him and admire him far too much for that. So I feel that this is an occasion to celebrate his accession to the throne in the best way I possibly can, with glorious music.
Wonderful. You know, the BBC thing that happened with the BBC choir.
I do.
Close to abolition, and now apparently it looks as if maybe they would not let them go. Would you say that this is also something to do with Charles being king now and maybe overseeing things, or is the distance between the BBC and the Buckingham Palace as large
I don't know.
As can be?
I can't answer that. I know that I was asked on the BBC Today programme about this, or rather, they were asking me about the coronation, and I changed the subject towards the BBC cuts, and I made quite an impassioned plea for a reprieve to the idea of them cancelling Britain's only professional salary chamber choir. And a lot of people joined in that protest, and there has been a temporary reprieve. Whether it lasts, who knows? Who knows? But it was a scandal. It was absolute scandal and completely ridiculous.
You were in unison with 140,000 subscribers of some petition.
Yeah.
And indeed. Simon was, of course, also saying, I wouldn't perform at the proms anymore if this is really happening. And
that's right.
And that's only one particle of what's happening in the cultural landscape in Great Britain right now, in England especially.
It's very discouraging. But curiously enough, in Britain, even though, you know, it's not just that we're das Land ohne Musik, because it's not true.
No.
But we're rather good at the freelance world of surviving, even if there have been savage government funding cuts or the BBC has lost its mojo. There's nearly always a bank of initiative and of inventiveness, innovation, mm-hmm. which has kept us going up to now. I'm not saying it's going to save us in the future, but there is at least a history of survival.
And this is the upside of the absence of Rundfunkorchester and staatliche Strukturen that would support all these arts, you know.
Indeed.
They don't know others, so they are always struggling, which is not very nice, but...
No.
And it ends up in some high quality still, which is amazing.
That's encouraging.
I've seen among the many, many records that you've made, this one beautiful a cappella with the Monteverdi Choir of the Compostela.
Oh, yeah, music. I did too, yes.
And I was wondering, did you do the pilgrimage yourself?
Yeah, but I didn't walk all the way.
Oh, you didn't walk all the way, but parts of it.
I walked every day, and it was in a bus the rest of the time, because we did 17 concerts in about 5 days, so we couldn't do it too leisurely. But it was a wonderful experience.
When did you do this?
2006, I think it was. And we just sang Spanish music of the Siglo d'Oro, of the Golden Age. So
yeah.
Vitoria, Morales, Alfonso Lobo, and Guerrero. I mean, magnificent music.
So not necessarily the program that you have on the record.
Some of it, yeah.
And some not.
And it's really important, because those places which are visited by pilgrims every year on their way to Santiago, they've got no music in them. And Spain had this fantastic golden age. And if you go into any of the great cathedrals of Spain now, if you go into Toledo or León or Ávila or Burgos, Segovia, you won't find music. And the music, the buildings become dimmed and dull if they don't have music to ignite them.
Yeah. And so you were performing in these cathedrals and in these halls.
And the clergy are not keen on it.
Uh-huh.
Clergy have a very strange attitude towards music, you know. I remember there was one guy...
Is it because of a rivalry? Or?
I think so, and the suspicion, I don't know. There was a pfarrer, when we were in Wittenberg, on Reformationstag mm-hmm. in 2000, and there was this very severe priest who came up to me at the end of the concert, and we'd sung Ein fester Burg ist unser Gott, and he said, Herr Gardiner, I see that you are going on to Rome next week. Take the good work on to Rome. Take it to Rome, because you know that what Luther said, that's a whore of a city.
That's very Protestant to say.
Very Protestant.
Last little subject I have to cover, of course, with you is the agricultural side of your life. you've grown up on a farm, you run a farm yourself, and I wonder, in between having grown up on a farm and running a farm, was there no farm at all, or was there always something where you would work for or be in touch with?
I've always tried to maintain that all through my life, and I was very lucky to grow up on the farm and to spend time milking cows and to dealing with sheep and horses and pigs and so on, and to be trained by my father, who was an ecologist and an original bio farmer and a founder member of the Soil Association, and he taught me a great deal. And they've been paralleled careers, parallel passions in my life all the way through, and I've never felt able or willing to sacrifice one for the other, because they're complementary to me. Even they're both quite stressful, but they're both of them music, and Landwirtschaft is also energy giving. It restores, it's restorative, and tree planting, and I find it really necessary to do both, and I'm privileged to have that choice or combination in my life.
So if I imagine you and your farm, it's not basically the office work, but it's really the groundwork and the digging and the doing. And
I'm banned from driving a tractor anymore because they've become so computerized, and I was really bad at that. And I love the physical work on the farm, and I still enjoy moving sheep, moving cattle, being there if I'm called on to at lambing or at calving. But I've got two very good people who are taking responsibility for that. Yes, but I'm very concerned with the policy of cropping, of how we decide on how we're going to market things, how we're going to cope with new restrictions. For example, in post-Brexit, how we cope with the lack of EEC funding, mm-hmm. how we're going to cope with Boris Johnson's appalling cop-out in signing deals with America and Australia about importing cheap and poorly
meat instead of supporting the homegrown.
Exactly. So I feel deeply involved in that and deeply troubled by it.
And is it really in peril what you are doing, or
it's potentially in peril? And I'm trying to involve more and more my children, because I've got three daughters who are all very supportive and very committed to sustainable farming, and they will carry on, you know, when I'm no longer around. But the decisions that we have to make now today are ones that they need to be involved in, mm-hmm. and for their children too, because I'm now a grandfather, and it's a big responsibility, and one has to really debate all the pros and cons of the arguments, mm-hmm. in order to find a way forward.
So then sometimes music can be a refuge of all these troubles, right?
Yes.
It's earthly,
exactly,
literally earthly subjects that you have to deal with.
And also the other way around, that, you know, when one's on tour and the stress gets to one thinks, okay, now what is going on the farm? Let's discuss how many trees we're going to plant and where we're going to plant them, where we're going to sell the lambs and so on, and how can we look after, how can we be custodians of the environment? That's the critical thing. And that's something, again, I share very much with His Majesty the King, because he's so committed. And he's been to the farm a couple of times.
Wonderful. Have you heard about this idea that digging in the earth releases hormones and certain substances that you breathe in that really respond to the oxytocin in the brain?
Is this Rudolf Steiner?
No, I think it's not Rudolf Steiner. I think it's much younger than Rudolf Steiner. And there have been some scientific proofs even for this. You know, why gardening makes you happy. It has to do with what comes out of the earth and what you breathe in.
Okay, how do you balance that with the notion that if you disturb the soil surface, that the carbon that you have sequestered in the soil is then released back in the atmosphere and in CO2, and then you're increasing climate
carbon footprint. So the one is maybe more individual and the other is more collective. I don't know how plays out. But
there's this big debate going on at the moment. It has been for many years, but the scientific debate about the soil disturbance, about carbon sequestering and carbon releasing. Do you use the plough? Is the plough the enemy, or is the plough the tool, the right tool? I mean, of course, some would argue that by ploughing in the last crop and ploughing in the weeds that otherwise would grow, that you may be taking a short-term gain, but you're undoing all the containment of the carbon that you've done in the top two or three inches of the soil, and you're destroying that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, the people who foster the use of glyphosate, you know, which is Roundup, Monsanto company,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
they're saying, well, yeah, just use Roundup and that's fine. Then you don't have to plow and then you keep the carbon underground. And you, it's a very, very contentious debate, very difficult to do. Of course, one doesn't want to use glyphosate or any form of pesticides or herbicides. On the other hand, one doesn't want to undo the good work that's been done in building up fertility in the soil.
Yeah. It's like den Teufel mit dem Beelzebub austreiben, as we say in German. Two different ways of dealing with the devil, you know.
Yeah.
You're trying to chase the devil with something that's even worse. So, John, it was really a pleasure for me.
And for me, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.